Well, once again, I welcome everyone to 2,000 Years, the Jewish Odyssey, and tonight is part six, sponsored as always by Becky Navikatz, Lili Nishrasiona, Ben Rabaria Leib. Tonight we discuss the 6th century, the Common Era. So I started thinking about this a few weeks ago with the question, what in the world happened in the 6th century, which is tonight's topic. Wondering how I'm going to fill even 45 minutes, because the 6th century, by the year 500, Europe was entrenched firmly in what became known as the Dark Ages, so-called not because of the absence of electricity, that was true also, but primarily because this era, about 6 centuries from, say, the 5th century to the 11th century, was embarrassingly tepid in its scientific or cultural achievements, especially compared to the Renaissance era, whose thinkers name this the Dark Ages. Documentary records of the 6th century are very scarce. Pursuit of knowledge and science just seemed to freeze, and suddenly, as if the world stopped its development. The world was, not coincidentally, aflame with conflict. One barbarian tribe after another pillaged and plundered, raided other tribes. In fact, the Gothic conquerors of Rome in 470 were the original barbarians. That's where the term came from. Most of these tribes had no use for Roman or Greek culture. So all the advances that had been made in terms of just civilization were on hold for quite a long period of time. There was a drastic reduction in world population, 20% loss in 2 centuries through the 6th century, owing to a famine that was caused by what's now thought to be several centuries of climate change, then known as global cooling. Global climate being cyclical, the only constant being the brief periods of hysteria that always accompany the cyclical changes, as today. There were huge migrations of population, the remnants of the population, across the world. Very critical for our study, it included Jews. By the year 500, Jews were no longer a majority in Eretz Yisrael, and that situation would not change until the latter half of the 20th century. So for 1,500 years, more or less, Jews were a minority population in the land of Israel. Now, it's axiomatic that the Jewish people, as such, never suffered through a dark age, if only because our pursuit of intellectual excellence precludes any embrace or even a celebration of ignorance. But it's also axiomatic that as it goes with the Goyim, so it goes with the Yidden. And we were affected enormously by the winds in the air of the 6th century of the Common Era. Our documentary record is also very thin. So one has to scratch beneath the surface to uncover the trends and events and personalities that had a lasting impact. Firstly, the era of the Amoraim, you recall, ended in the year 500 with the death of Ravina II, the nephew of the first, the well-known Ravina, and the era known as the Tekufas HaGeonim did not start until 589. So what happened during these 89 years, and what precipitated the beginning of what was known as the Tekufas HaGeonim? Well, Jews in Bavel in this century, at least at the beginning, were still led by Reish Galusa, Reish HaGalut, and the main yeshivas still vying for influence, depending on who the Reish Yeshiva were the Surah and Papadisa. But the spiritual leaders in the 6th century were known as Rabbanon Saboroi. Saboroi, clarifiers, explainers. And they're the ones who put the finishing touches on the Talmud, adding nothing to the halachic discussions, but adding clarifications, elucidations. So there are gedolim, sometimes referred to openly by the Rishonim, other times you can deduce it from later works. For example, there's some mesechtos that will begin with a question, why is this here? Like Nozir, there's a Mishnah, and the Gemara starts, why is Meseches Nozir in Seder Noshim? Or in Sota, why does Sota follow Nozir? Those almost parenthetical remarks were inserted by the Rabbanan Saboroi to clarify the Gemara. In the rare case, and there are rare cases, in the low dozens, they'll be mentioned in the Talmud as well. And we know their names. Rav Rechumai is mentioned in Ervin, Daf Yud Aleph, Amid Aleph. He was in a Machlokas of Rav Yosef of Pumbedisa. In the second generation, Rav Simonos, Rav Shishiva Pumbedisa, Rav Eina, Rav Shishiva of Sura. So they have scattered references in the Gemara. Or in fact, the Daf Yomi is learning Kiddushin now. The first two Dafim of Kiddushin, the Mishnah starts, Yishin Makadish Shlosha Drachim. The first two Dafim talk about the origin of Kiddusha Kesef and Kinyan generally. Those two Dafim are in fact insertions of the Rabbanon Saboroi. That's what they did. Additionally, they wrote the Mesechtos Ktanos, Mesechas Sofrim, Mesechas Kalo, Mesechas Smochos, etc. And apparently, because they didn't sign their work, they added to the Talmud what became very familiar, very helpful to us, colons, denoting the end of one topic and the beginning of another, or fragments of the words of the Mishnah that introduce a new topic. The classic stuff done by editors, that's what they did. But they didn't change the Gemara's conclusions, nor the essential flow of a sugya. There are occasions when the Gemara is left without a halachic conclusion. Gittin Dav Zayim and Aleph is a classic case, where one of the Gaonim there, one of the Rabbanan Saboroi, Rav Achai, is quoted as explaining a teaching, a reference to Tziklag, so the Gemara is left without an answer, so he gave the answer. They're also less well known to us than the Tanoim, even the Amoroim, because their names are not mentioned that frequently, like book editors, good book editors, they're generally in the background. So there are lists of names from the time of the Gaona that mention most or all of them. Shura Gaon mentions them. There's a book called the Sefer Tanon V'Amoron that mentioned them. They aren't unknown, but biographical data about most of them is scanty. Now these figures ruled but briefly, except for Rav Yosef, who was in Pumbedisa for 40 years. Most of them died a few short years after serving as Rosh Yeshiva. But they bear the responsibility and the great zchus of keeping the Torah alive and for providing leadership and continuity in very trying times. And for something else as well, which seems so obvious in retrospect, but in fact was quite remarkable, even transformative for Jewish life in the exile, to which we'll return in a few moments. What was happening in our world? Well, you recall that in Persia, the Sassanid dynasty had turned on the Jews during the latter part of the 5th century, even executing some of the later Amoraim in the 470s. Things worsened from there as the Parthian Empire became weaker and more fragmented. There was a king, King Kavad I, who ruled an exceptionally long time from 488 to 531 in Persia. That's 43 years. And he imposed brutal decrees on the Jews, including the founding of a new religion or a new interpretation of his Zoroastrian faith. All this under the influence of a Zoroastrian priest named Mazdak. Mazdak really founded his own religion, and its basic tenets are not unfamiliar to us today, although the religion died out long ago. He advocated, Mazdak did, what is known today as a prototype of communism. So for example, in order to reduce strife and the influence of the Zoroastrian clergy and to promote peace and harmony, Mazdak insisted on the abolition of private property. There was no such thing as private ownership, which essentially did away with theft. You can't steal anything if no one owns anything. He then abolished marriage as well, which among other things does away with adultery by allowing free and uninhibited love. I think that religion still exists, by the way. He banned the consumption of meat as stemming from the world of darkness in the Zoroastrian scheme of the universe, and he simply advocated good conduct, living in peace and friendship with all men, and he held again, Mazdak did, that those institutions, private property, individual marriages, all those created strife by a person claiming for himself something unique to him or to her. And therefore, if everybody shares, everyone lives in peace. Well, it sounds great in theory. Unfortunately, like many such attempts, not everyone signed on, especially the people who had the property, meaning the rich, but also those groups that wanted to conquer Persia and to kill Mazdak. Kavad the First, though, the king did sign on, even allowing Mazdak to sleep with the queen. But the rich did not, and they resented when Mazdak's forces raided their homes and palaces to seize their wealth. Mazdak himself died in the mid-520s, although his religion lived on for some time after. He claimed to be a prophet. Now, obviously, such a religion, which attempts to abrogate Losignov and Losinov, among other Dibros, posed a problem for the Jews of Bavel. And Mazdak's professions of peace and brotherhood towards all men did not extend to the Jews. But first, because of the anarchy that was set off by the Persians' incessant wars against outsiders, as well as the internal turmoil between the Zoroastrian establishment and this new group of Mazdak, there was great instability, and as a result, in the mid-5-teens, around 515, the Reish Galusa, Marzutra I, not to be confused with Marzutra the Amora, declared an independent Jewish state in part of Persia, with its capital at Mechoza. Mechoza, you remember, was the city of Rava. The independent Jewish state lasted just a few short years, and when it was defeated in battle, Marzutra was either beheaded or crucified by Kavad I, perhaps even both. A wave of persecution then ensued. The position itself of the Reish Galusa was temporarily abolished. The yeshivos, both Sura first and then Pumbedisa, had to close. And the Saboroim relocated to a city, another city in Persia, called Firuz Shapur, evidently named for the popular kings of the previous two centuries. What does Rav Shreira say about this time? Two words. Hava Za'afa. It was a time of anger. And of course he couldn't say much more, as typically rebellions could never be discussed openly while we still lived in the same kingdom. But Marzutra the First had done two things that were both prescient and life-changing. In the year 500, he traveled to Eretz Yisrael with his young son, and he left his young son to be raised in Israel away from the turmoil of Bavel. So that ensured that the hereditary Reish Galusa position would survive. Reish Galusa was a descendant, a male descendant of David HaMelech. And indeed, Marzutra's son became Reish Galusa when the position was restored in 550. Marzutra himself, the second thing, which really had a far-reaching consequence, when he came to Eretz Yisrael in the year 500, he brought with him a completed Talmud Bavli, handwritten, of course, the very first to be taken out of Bavel, and he left in Eretz Yisrael with the Rabbanim there. So this ensured that Torah discussions would remain the same, and the Torah would continue to be propagated. In fact, within a very short time, the Talmud was copied and made its way to Italy and then to other European countries already in the 6th century. So despite all the vicissitudes and all the harassment of Jews and the different cultures and governments under which Jews lived, it was still certain that the Torah would always unite the Jews. Same language, same issues. And we know, Ad Hayom, any Jew in any part of the world could become part of a discussion, become a Talmud Chacham, find common ground with other Jews. And in fact, that is the common language. Culturally, you'll find tremendous differences between Jews of Spain and Poland and North Africa and Arabia. But what brings all Jews together would be the Talmud. So it united us, it preserved us. In a few centuries, we'll see questions started to be asked from different parts of the world to a particular goal or great Rav, and the Talmud then gave us this special identity, because it was a closed book to outsiders, even to many Jews, a special identity that perplexed our tormentors, especially the Christians. That young son of Marzutro became known later as Marzutro II. So he became the Rosh Yeshiva in Tveria. It was called on the Reish Pirka in the 530s. He began disseminating the Talmud Bavli in Israel, and then later he returned to Bavel. Meanwhile, Christianity spent the century in stagnation. 14 popes ruled, which is pretty much the average. The general average of popes is 7 years. 265 popes in all, and I guess 2,000 years or so. The recent popes have served a little longer. But the nominal seat of the Catholic Empire, Rome, had almost disappeared from a population. Think about it. A population of over 1 million people in the first century, the Common Era, around the time of the Churban. Rome in the 6th century had 20,000 people. From more than 1 million down to 20,000. It was physically ravaged, and in terms of civilization, it was a leader in nothing. But the Eastern Empire, the Byzantines, they remained stable, if not strong. Their language was Latin. Already in the 5th century, the emperor Theodosius II had fortified the walls of Constantinople to the extent that, notwithstanding the Hun victories in Rome and elsewhere, even Attila the Hun himself could not vanquish Constantinople. And when Attila the Hun died in 453, his empire collapsed, and many of his troops signed on as mercenaries for the Byzantines. And yet, despite the fact that the Byzantines were strong and the Roman part of the empire was weak, the popes retained spiritual leadership on an overwhelmingly ignorant population. And the Talmud especially exercised them. In an era in which the Christians claimed to be the exclusive truth and the word of the pope was law through the emperor, I mentioned this past Shabbos as well, we looked at the institution of Machlokas. The very idea of a religious work that was, so to speak, pluralistic, that is to say, had a diversity of opinions, with a machlokas on every daf, that was unsettling to Catholicism. And they could never wrap their minds around that. To a great extent, to this day, they can't wrap their minds around that. If Abaye and Rava can disagree, why can't two bishops disagree? That's not the way the religions of the world work. They're very monolithic. Yadus is different. So the existence of such a work like the Talmud, notwithstanding all their other objections to it, like the references, the Christological references they didn't like, the very existence of such a work was troubling. The Byzantine Empire, the first famous emperor of the 6th century was Justin I, became the emperor in 518. Justin came from humble origins. He'd been a soldier, worked his way up to general, through the ranks, finding himself the only commander in Constantinople when the emperor died, and he took over. Justin I took over, despite the fact he was illiterate. But he's best known as the uncle of and the mentor of Justinian, who succeeded him in 527 and ruled for 38 years and made our lives miserable. Justinian was a very harsh ruler. Like many Rishoim, he also became a saint, Saint Justinian. He succeeded in recapturing a good chunk of the Western Empire, and he was a fairly religious Catholic, which is never good for the Jews. But he's most famous for what became known as the Code of Justinian. It's a complete restatement of Roman law that was promulgated shortly after he took power over the course of 5 years. It superseded all prior Roman law. This was the Code of Justinian, known as the Corpus Juris Civilis, body of civil law, dealt with many different areas of law. But importantly for us, it enshrined into law Augustine's notion, think back to the 3rd and 4th centuries, of persecuting the Jews, but not exterminating the Jews. That became part of Justinian's code. We're no stranger to such codes, but again, indirectly, we're the beneficiary of it to some extent, that it didn't become lawful to kill Jews, but rather to repress us. So the code established Orthodoxy as the only legal religion of the state, and required all residents under the jurisdiction of the state to profess that religion, except for Jews. That clause did not target Jews, who again, based on Augustine, there was an effort to keep Jews Jews, but to persecute them. So we were not forced to convert under Justinian's code. Rather, that targeted the Arians, that ancient, but now construed to be deviant sect, Christian sect, that did not deify Jesus. They held he wasn't a god. So that was now antithetical to Catholicism. Arianism was outlawed, paganism was outlawed, the Zoroastrians were widely persecuted, they were forced to convert to Christianity. Under Justinian's code, we were not. We had a special set of laws, what Justinian labeled the servitus iudaeorum, the servitude of the Jews. So again, notice how Judaism wasn't banned like Arianism or paganism, it was just suppressed. For several hundred years thereafter, Jews were subject to Justinian's code. Many of these existed far into modern times. For example, no Jew could become a citizen of a Christian country or hold public office. No Jew could testify against a Christian, nor could a Jew have a Christian convert as a servant. In various places, the Shema was banned as a denial of the Trinity, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. He restricted the use of the Mishnah. So the Mishnah is not divine, and therefore it distorts the true teaching, so to speak, of the Bible. He either banned the use of Hebrew in Tefillah, or some maintained he banned the insistence that only Hebrew be used, and he allowed other languages to be used in Tefillah. Now this code, both as it related to the Jews and generally, was supplemented by novellae every few years that would be issued that would sometimes be promulgated in response to new conquests and have new harsh repressive measures. So for example, in 535, Justinian conquered North Africa and he confiscated all the shuls there and the pagan houses of worship as well. He banned the construction of new ones. And he began the practice, right here, common for the next 1,000 years, of converting shuls into churches upon conquest. He also, therefore, catalyzed the reluctance of Jews, also for the next 1,000 years, to build large, impressive buildings as shuls. Because what's the point? You're always at the whim of the Christian ruler. If they like the building too much, they'll just confiscate it. So that's why there were no great shuls in the latter part of the first millennium and even for centuries into the second millennium as well. Well, the revulsion was mutual. Jews were disgusted, frankly, by the Byzantines' embrace of icons and statues and paintings that were venerated in their house of worship. Really, we saw it, there's no difference between them and the Greeks, the pagan Greeks. We saw no difference between Greek Orthodoxy, Roman Orthodoxy, the way they practiced their religion just struck the Jewish mind as idolatrous, even pagan, and a throwback to Roman times and the very antithesis of Hashem Echad. So if at one time the Christians claimed descent from or affinity for Judaism, by this time Jews were completely repelled by Christianity. Of course, our distaste for it also drew their resentment and their work product in churches and the frescoes, the mosaics, etc. is still a familiar sight in Israel and elsewhere. For Jews, it was a very difficult time. Adding to the misery of the Jews and the world was a devastating plague, a cataclysm, if you think back. A bubonic plague struck the world in 541-542. That lasted almost two and a half centuries and killed an estimated 100 million people. Such was medicine at the time. Justinian himself was afflicted, although he survived, 40% of his Constantinople was wiped out. That was the last dreadful plague that would affect the world until the Black Death of the 14th century. Unlike the Black Death, there's no evidence that Jews were blamed for this. They hadn't yet caught on to that accusation. But one inevitable result of this trauma was that Justinian became even more religious in the 540s, and that did not bode well for Jews. Now, there's one unintended consequence of the bubonic plague. Again, you look back and you see how history plays itself out. The plague stopped Justinian's army in its tracks, halting his westward expansion. He had conquered land. Remember, he's coming from the Byzantine Empire, Turkey, Asia Minor, etc. He conquered land in an arc all the way to Spain and reclaimed other Roman lands. But as we look back, we could say this was also the Yad Hashem, because he had to stop. He couldn't conquer the rest of Europe, and so we did not fall under the dominion of one evil empire, which in fact has been our fate, our positive fate in all these centuries. We're never the citizens of this one evil empire, but rather always of at least two empires, empires that are always warring with each other. So sometimes we're caught in the middle, but other times it worked to our favor. Like Yaakov said in last week's Sedra, that if one machane is attacked, the other machane, so they will have a refuge, they will escape. Had Justinian conquered the world, then who knows what would have happened. But in fact, the plague stopped him. As such, in the 6th century, or by the 6th century, there were flourishing Jewish communities already in Italy, in France, in Germany, and in Spain as well. Now, there's one very fascinating and even enigmatic event that happened in the early part of the 6th century. In 515, a fellow named Yusuf du Nuas, Arab name, conquered part of Yemen from the Ethiopians, that's in southern Arabia. He converted to Judaism. He established a Jewish republic, independent republic, in Yemen, and he began persecuting Christians, persecuting them as retribution for the persecution of Jews in Christian lands. In a short time, he killed probably around 20,000 people. His reign and kingdom lasted less than a decade, until roughly the early 520s or so, as Christian tribes from Arabia and elsewhere invaded Yemen and disposed of him. So that was Yusuf du Nuas. But in fact, there's some who say that the Jewish kingdom there in Yemen lasted over 100 years. And the original king was a convert, the entire kingdom was Jewish, and that Yusuf du Nuas was in fact the last king, the one whose fate was that he would be conquered and killed. He was the last of them. If that's the case, then he had a century where, removed from civilization, there was a Jewish kingdom in southern Yemen. Jews were very often in the middle, both suffering under the Christian persecutions of the Byzantines, as well as in a conflict between the Byzantines and the Persians, and the Persian persecutions altogether. All the external conflicts that the Persians suffered, as well as the problems I mentioned with the Zoroastrians and Mazdak, led the Persians to seek internal stability through repression. And the Byzantines and the Persians were always at odds for political reasons, for military reasons. The kings didn't seem to have that much to do but to wage war against each other, and especially for religious reasons. See, Christianity always was a proselytizing faith. The Byzantines and the Roman portion of the empire were already near a schism on religious doctrines, and the prior encroachments of the Christians into Persia in the 3rd century had produced there a uniquely Persian blend of Christianity and Zoroastrianism called Maniachism, the Maniachans. That was a heresy, of course, for the Byzantines, and that had to be fought. So that religion, named for the prophet Mani, was for several centuries one of the most popular religions in the world. All its holy books were written in Aramaic. Its creeds, pretty similar to Zoroastrianism, in that they posited a dualistic world with conflicts between the forces of light and darkness, the good soul versus the evil body, no one omnipotent God, the Father of greatness, he was called, light, having five, get this, called Shechinas. Of course, the Aramaic word, or the Hebrew word, Shechina meaning presence, that the Father of greatness had five Shechinas, or residences, dwelling places, so the word itself imparts the type of concoction and amalgam this religion was. So you have the Mazdaks, and you have the Manichaeans, and you have the Zoroastrians, and you have the encroachment of the Christians, all in Babel, and in this milieu, the Rabbanon, all of them, by the way, against Jews, and in this milieu, the Rabbanon Saboroi labored to keep the Jewish people alive and the Torah primary. They were not aided at all by a dearth of Jewish political leadership. It's not just the recent times that we suffer from that fate. It's happened other times as well. So some of the leaders of the Jews, Huna bar Kahana, for example, were incompetent. Others, a Jew named Pachada, were ineligible because they were not descendants of David, but they had bribed their way into the position of Reish Galusa through a government appointment, shades again of the second Beis HaMikdash era and the Kahuna Gadola. So the fate of the Jews depended somewhat on the quality and caliber of the leader. So the aforementioned Marzutra was a strong, powerful leader, Marzutra the first, perhaps too strong for his own good. After he imploded, for some reason, his declaration of independence was perceived by the Parthians as a hostile, rebellious act. Who knows why? So it was ill-fated. When he was killed, the institution of the Reish Galusa was abolished completely and indeed went decades without being filled. Now, this was not necessarily harmful. Symbols are great, but substance matters more. And without a titular political leader, the Jews of the 6th century reverted to accepting the supremacy of the Torah leadership. Those Rabbonim, Rosh Yeshiva, wherever they were, they became not only spiritual leaders, but they were the political leaders as well. They were the ones who gave daily guidance. So the situation in Babel throughout this century was volatile, again pointing to the prescience of the giants of the 5th century who had shepherded the Talmud Bavli into existence. Again, that's God's promise. The Torah will never leave us. Had Rav Ashi not begun the process, and had the Talmud Bavli not been committed to writing in the 5th century, it would have been impossible to do it in the 6th century, given the turbulence of the times. Now, after the death of Rav Ravai in 559, Pumbedisa was closed. The Torah was forced underground. Several decades of persecution followed, but Rav Shirgon writes as Vohavu Yochlin Lemikba Pirkei. Chazal had to abandon a Babylonian Jewish custom, the weekly sermon before Musaf. They could not be Mikba the Pirkei because of the threats of the Persians. So he had to cancel the weekly drasha because of the Persians. After that, it's the Jews who complain about it. They could not open a new yeshiva, and they had to keep a low profile for decades. Although they moved, as I mentioned, to Firuz Shapur in 569, that yeshiva lasted 90 years, they did not wield the same authority. But in fact, there was a change in Bavel. Once the authority of the Reish Galusa diminished, and the authority of the Rosh Yeshiva was enhanced, that itself began a new era. That uncertainty and unstable leadership opened the door to the next great era of Jewish history, the period of the Gaonim, which began in 589 and ended in 1038. Who were the Gaonim? They were the heads, respectively, of the yeshivos in either Pumbedisa and Sura. The first Gaon, Mar Hanan of Ashkaya, reopened the yeshiva in Pumbedisa 589. Then Sura of Pumbedisa was dominant, so he became the acknowledged leader of Babylonian Jewry, known then and for the next several centuries as the Gaon, His Excellency. Soon after, the yeshiva in Sura also reopened. It also regained its prominence. So for almost five centuries, you had these two magnificent institutions in existence, and Jewish leadership was divided between the Gaonim of the yeshivos, who were the Torah leaders, and the secular political leader, the Reish Galusa. That was usually a government appointment. That position would be restored in the 7th century. Now remember, the Reish Galusa, in his heyday, was not just a title, but a very important figure. He was the representative of the Jews before the king, as well as the wielder of tremendous power over the Jews. Reish Galusa, the power of taxation, he had judicial power, impunity, he could punish people, flog them, jail them, he had legislative power, but as the Gaonim of the two yeshivas preceded the reinstitution of the Reish Galusa in the 7th century, the Gaonim themselves already had prior and greater authority, and what matters more, the respect of the people. Their appointments were not political, not even hereditary, were based exclusively on their Torah prominence. The Gaonim, therefore, had a very high profile. Indeed, they're all known to us for the five centuries, 52 Rosh Yeshiva in Sura, 42 in Pumbedisa. They're well known, but unlike in the Talmud, whether Tanoim or Amoraim, their Talmidim are almost completely unknown. In a departure from the style of the Talmud, where the Amoraim are judged on their merits and speak for themselves, here, now, all pronouncements came from the Gaonim, and we know very little about their disciples. The Yarchei Kala were also restored in Adar and Elul, and a contemporaneous description of the yeshiva reveals that it looked and sounded a lot like the Sanhedrin of old. The way they sat in a semicircle, the various rows that existed, the brighter Talmidim, the more advanced Talmidim in the front, going all the way to the back, nothing personal, and then as people grew in knowledge, or someone was, I guess, traded or waived, others would move up and take their seats, exactly how the Sanhedrin functioned. The existence of the Gaonim in a formal way both stabilized and elevated Jewish life, and finally, at the end of a very, very trying century, it gave the people pride in the Torah and its masters, and over time, a very hectic and chaotic time, they became widely accepted even outside the Jewish world. It would be vital as new and long-term challenges, cataclysmic battle between Byzantium and Parthia, for example, and another new religion would come onto the world scene. All of that would arise in the 7th century that would change the world dramatically. So, just to summarize, this first, most well-known century of the Dark Ages, really a very much unknown and uncelebrated century. The 6th century, the Common Era, saw the final editing of the Talmud Bavli through the work of the Rabbanan Sabaroi, including the publication of the Sechtos Ktanos, and, importantly, the dissemination of the Talmud Bavli in Eretz Yisrael and beyond. The Jews suffered terribly under harsh religious persecution wherever we were. There was no refuge at all under the thumb of Kavod the First and the Mazdaks in Parthia, under Justinian and the Eastern Christians in the Byzantine Empire. Justinian enshrined into law Augustine's attitude towards Jews that precipitated 12 centuries of authorized legal repressive measures. Restrictions on civil and political rights and religious practices became typical, with each subsequent society doing little more than temporary adjustments or minor fine-tuning. But our faith from the 6th century, from Justinian's code, easily for the next 13, 14 centuries, whatever happened in the Christian world was somehow an outgrowth of Justinian's code. It was a very short-lived Jewish kingdom in Yemen that provided a historical footnote and, of course, a rarity in our long history. At the same time, Jewish leadership suffered, a Reish Galusa overreached and was executed, The institution itself was temporarily abolished. Jews were caught in the middle of warring religions and nations. But in the 7th century, the deck would be reshuffled in a way that still impacts the world with the creation of Islam. I thank you very much. See you next week.